Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, today we're going to talk about a set of principles outlined by the American Psychological Association to help students learn more effectively.
That's right. And this comes out of an earlier talk that we did.
Yeah.
This week, earlier this week.
Yeah.
By our friend and colleague.
Well, you know, the timing of these is so interesting, because what happened is we recorded a podcast for next week.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were recording that podcast, we're thinking, you know what, we really should review those 20 principles. And we're thinking, well, you know what, we don't have one of our detailed podcasts recorded right for this week yet. So we're kind of doing it backwards, because
right,
the podcast that we did that triggered the idea for this actually doesn't come out until after we've recorded this one.
Now, if you seem confused by that, fear not, because I was. And
yeah,
I live with him. Well, I live with you, but I live. I spend more time with you than I do with anybody else.
14 hours.
And I don't understand what he just said.
No.
But our friend and colleague in the UK did a little blog about learning principles as they apply in the UK system. It's
right,
a little bit different in the UK than it is here.
Right.
And so we decided to, well, let's take a look at all of those principles, because he extracted five of these basic principles. So we went into the APA website and looked at the entire document.
Yeah.
And fascinating stuff, because education continues to be a challenge in our country. There are a number of recurring problems that we have yet to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but when you go into these, APA and other organizations do address some of these issues.
Right.
And it's interesting that this kind of information isn't reaching the street level,
right,
building level,
professionals. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So it's the, and as you said, it sort of, it has a long history.
It does.
Surprisingly long history, despite the fact that, you know, I went to graduate school in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, and we never talked about any of this. We didn't go through any
You
of
didn't?
This.
Mm-mm. When were you there?
No, 99 through 2005.
Wow.
Yeah. So
and
never,
you didn't go?
Not as far as I remember.
Okay, because the original document
was
1990.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was an effort by APA. It was part of an, APA was part of the effort.
Right.
To shift teaching from teacher-centered
right
curriculum to a learner-centered curriculum.
Right.
Because prior to that, until the 1980s,
right,
we had a very teacher-oriented approach to education. And in the 80s and early 90s, some of our theories began to change.
Right.
And it became obvious that we needed to move toward a learner-centered approach rather than a teacher-centered approach. So the first document was about that. It was 14 principles
right
that shifted from teacher-centered to learning-centered.
Right.
But you never saw that.
Nope. Nope.
That's interesting.
Right. So in 2015...
Because you were in an APA-approved program.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And so in 2015, the APA had a group... and there were, including some
educators right
who sort of revised and expanded.
Right.
So now we have 20 principles that are actually sorted across five different psychological domains.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that these are really important, not just for the classroom, but
right
a lot of these are really important for parents and for adult learners alike. I mean, when you're in, whether you're in college or graduate school, or high school, or middle school. It
right
doesn't matter. All of these principles are important regardless.
That's right. They were promulgated for K-12.
Right.
But they explicitly state that the principles could be applied to any kind of a learning situation. So every company trains workers, and these same principles could apply to the training of workers.
Absolutely.
it starts K-12, but it could apply to early childhood.
Right.
And so, and homes.
Right.
You know, if you want to start teaching your children, this would be a good document to know about.
Right.
And to use.
Yeah. So the link is certainly in the show notes as always. And if you, as you get to it, the first paragraph actually has a link, another link.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That actually takes you to the original documents and a lot more information. Mm-hmm. So if you want to check that out, that is all there and available. So let's kind of get to the first domain. And the first domain is cognition and learning.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How do students think and learn
right.
is sort of the focus of these different principles mm-hmm. within here. And so the first principle is a growth mindset.
Right.
As they have sort of subtitled for this one, students' beliefs and perceptions about intelligence and ability affect their cognitive functioning and learning.
Mm-hmm.
So when the student him or herself has a growth mindset,
correct.
If they appreciate and they value and they understand their ability to learn and to mm-hmm. grow, they are going to be much more likely to grow and learn.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We have a wonderful colleague. Her name is Carol Dweck, mm-hmm. and she has published for years on this topic.
Right.
And she has railed against this idea of, well, this is what your these are your intellectual abilities, right. and so this is what you should be able to, this is what you can do in school.
Right.
And she's saying, no, that's all wrong.
Right.
We have to have a growth mindset. No matter where you are, all of this can improve.
Right.
And she has spent her whole career talking about having a growth mindset.
Right.
And instead of having, I forget what she called it, rather than having an entity view, you have, I forget what her term is, but rather than thinking of IQ as fixed,
right.
rather than thinking of, for example, the best example is when kids say, I'm not good at math.
Right.
And she said, that's all wrong. We
right.
cannot let children think that way. Sadly, there are teachers who think that way.
Right.
Well, honey, you're just not good in math. Let's do something else.
Right.
That does a disservice to children.
Mm-hmm.
We have to find, you might not be learning math as it's presented. It mm-hmm. doesn't mean you can't learn math.
Right.
You just can't, you're just not learning it the way it's being presented.
Mm-hmm.
So Carol Dweck has argued for years that we have to change the approach,
right.
not let the child believe that she's not good in math.
Right. And the other aspect that they emphasize here is something we've talked about before, the Angela Duckworth
yeah.
work on grit.
Grit. Right.
You know, that persistence and determination
right.
and critical thinking.
That's what's important.
All of that is really important right. here with that growth mindset.
So. And sadly, many of us don't learn that until we're much older.
Right.
And we've already sacrificed some right. years of our education thinking that we can't do it. And suddenly we discover, gee, I guess I could have done this.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. The second principle is prior knowledge.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I think that this is a lesson we have learned from a long history of failure, of making mistakes. Because we were talking about this the other day. We were looking up some former court cases. And we looked at Larry
right.
P. versus Riles,
right.
mm-hmm. Which was looking at the sort of phenomenon from the 70s.
Earlier,
60s, 70s. Where in African-American boys were being disproportionately identified as educably mentally handicapped
right.
by the IQ test that we had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is that, of course, prior knowledge, prior experience,
right.
limited their ability to perform well on some of these
right.
tests.
They just didn't know this stuff.
They just didn't okay. know.
And the example I use is, well, first of all, children of privilege are taken places. They go mm-hmm. to museums. They travel to different
mm-hmm.
cities. So if you live in Florida, I don't know, are there lighthouses? Yeah, there are a couple of lighthouses here. But if you go to Maine, lighthouses dot the coast.
Right.
So if your family travels, you know what a lighthouse is. And a lighthouse is on almost every IQ test for
right.
some reason. But the example I use is a transom. Okay. Now, most people have no idea what a transom is.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have windows above doors, and that was a transom, but we don't have that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Where people would see a transom, it's the back of a sailboat. Well, once again, if you've never been on a sailboat, if you're fortunate enough to be on a sailboat, you know exactly what a transom is.
Right.
So again, you have this prior knowledge that allows you to make connections with new information
right.
that you gather.
Right.
So frequently, kids will say, well, oh yeah, I remember that. That's this. And then the new information right. relates to that information. And
right.
it's, and you start building this knowledge base.
Yeah.
You know where to put it.
Yeah. You know? Well, and the that's an interesting example because I think even adults...
Most adults wouldn't know.
I don't know what a transom is.
No.
But the example that I use is one that I had heard before because it was the example that they talked about with elementary school kids was simply Winnie the Pooh. Students who came from low income or in poverty areas had no idea what Winnie the Pooh was.
Right.
And so when they showed it and said, okay, who is this?
Right.
They would say, oh, it's a teddy bear or something like that.
Right.
But they would have no idea that it was Winnie the Pooh.
Or Paddington.
Right.
You know, most kids, I mean, our children do
right.
because we know about it. But yeah, you're right. They would know that. Charles Schulz.
Mm-hmm.
Peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer syndicated, I don't
right.
think. And I have a Snoopy tie. Okay, mm-hmm. got, you know, 800 yep. years ago, back in the 1800s. And I'm surprised when people know who that is, because adults know exactly who it is,
right.
but most children don't have a clue.
Right.
So if that was a picture on a test,
right.
they don't know who Snoopy is, because
right.
Snoopy's not, it's not in the popular press anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
yeah, you're right.
So. But prior knowledge is a major factor when it comes to...
I think it was the KBC. When the KBC first came... It's an IQ test.
The Kaufman Assessment...
Battery for... KABC. Kaufman Assessment Battery for Children.
Yeah.
When it first came out, they had a picture of Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yeah.
That iconic photo of him standing over Sonny Liston.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew... Not everybody.
Yeah.
Because kids had no idea who...
Right,
Muhammad Ali was.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And as we're talking about this, and we're kind of getting off on this tangent here, but there's a current IQ test that asks people to sort different things, different people into whether they are a celebrity, whether they're a scientist, and you know there are people listed on there that I don't know that most kids. I think that test starts at for people 10 years and older. If they would know who Bill Cosby is,
they would have no reason to
know. He hasn't been, you know, except for, you know.
He's been in the news, but they wouldn't have accessed that either.
And they wouldn't necessarily associate him with being an actor.
No.
Or comedian.
That's right.
From that. So it's interesting how we develop tests. And of course, we're talking about this from the context of tests, but certainly when it comes to learning, prior knowledge is everything. My son's in a history class right now. And they're going through the formation of the country. And, you know, he's sitting in class and they're talking about, well, we have one division of Congress versus two divisions of Congress. And he says, you know, does anybody know what that's called? And a student calls out the answer. And my son's like, how would anybody know that?
Wait,
it's like, well, you know, they have some prior knowledge. They
right.
you know, they remember from their civics class, you know, what that's. Right. What that is. So prior knowledge is a key factor.
And the more prior knowledge you have, the bigger your knowledge base
right.
can be, and the better you're going to do, not only on IQ tests, you're going to do right. better in school just because you know more.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The third principle is are the limits of stage theories.
This one I found fascinating.
Yes. Yes. Because we think about stage theories very often in psychology and in
we teach it.
Cognitive development and everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we always talk about the stages of development. We talk about, well, you go through pre-operational and this
sure.
and this and so on. But there are some limits to that.
Yeah, this to me was the most fascinating of the 20.
Yeah.
Because I'm teaching this semester. And, you know, Freud told us, he was the first to say children are different
mm-hmm.
and they develop in stages.
Mm-hmm.
And then his disciple, Erikson, gave us stages of psychosocial development.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just think that way.
Right.
It is the way psychologists and educators think. And we tell our students, we have to use Piaget's theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
Jean Piaget was a cognitive stages
right.
of development.
Right. And so he said, you know, prior to age 7, you shouldn't expect children to be able to think this way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a child before the age of 7 doesn't have the capacity to do this.
Right.
This challenges that notion.
Yeah.
And it's the first, I'll confess, it's the first challenge that I've seen to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, certainly we're hesitant to throw those theories out. Because
I wouldn't dare.
Because those theories have held in many ways.
They do.
But the problem is, and here's what I think the problem is with these, and we'll probably be talking about this with some of the other principles, is that those stages are based upon aggregate data. It's based upon
the
kids
average
overall.
Kid. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when you try to apply principles associated with kids overall to one particular kid, you're going to fall short.
Right. And I think that's what this speaks to, is that this is more about the outliers than in general. Because in general, most 8-year-olds don't have the cognitive capacity to handle calculus. They just,
right.
Their brains just don't work that way. Are there 8-year-olds who can? Obviously, because we have kids in college at 12 or 13 who are doing these advanced... They shouldn't be able to, according to stage theory, but they do. But they're the outliers.
Right.
Okay, so I think this is more about
the
exceptional
students. And they mentioned Vygotsky and that importance of scaffolding and you know, the zone of proximal development.
Yeah, I mean, if your dad is a carpenter... Mm-hmm. And you work with him when you're young, you're going to be able to do things at 7 or 8 that most other kids can't. I grew up in Amish country.
Mm-hmm.
You tease me about that every once in a while. And those boys at 15 or 16 are skilled craftsmen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, skilled craftsmen who can do everything that you want a carpenter to do. But that's because they've been working with their dads in that, with the scaffolding that Vygotsky talked about.
Yeah.
Because they've been working with their dads since they were little boys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They weren't distracted by Winnie the Pooh.
So
the fourth principle is facilitating context. And this is, you know, this is making it relevant.
Right.
You know, when you're thinking about the things that you're teaching kids, whether it's your own children or you're a teacher and you're working with your students of any age level, any grade level, making it relevant. Facilitating the context in which this information is important and relevant is really critical for that integration of the information
that's
into their function.
You have to make it meaningful to them,
right.
And that's one of the principles that Den talked about in his was this context, the importance of context.
Right. So the fifth one is practice, and we've talked about this in podcasts before. In the past, homework was practice.
Right.
Then there was this huge shift where homework became part of the, I don't even know what to call it. It became part of the grade. It became part of the...
Your performance grade.
Mastery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were expected to have mastered it so that when you turned in your homework, it was perfect. It was graded for perfection, for mastery.
Mm-hmm.
And that shift really... change things for the way that we think about practice. Because, you know, if you're teaching a new math principle and you give the students homework, you know, you're working on it in class and you give the students homework and they go home and they're supposed to practice it at home with this through this homework, but then you grade it for accuracy. Well, so now you've taken it away so that students who don't yet have it mastered have to learn from their parents or have to learn from themselves. Without the expertise of the teacher.
And
that's when we get into all these conflicts of, well, that's not the way the teacher taught it. That's not the way we're learning it. That's not the way you're supposed to do it. And that frustration where we're having, you know, hours long homework sessions. It's just, you know, we've really moved away from that.
I have to tell you something.
Okay.
Practice makes perfect is what we typically think about.
Say,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I like about this is you have to practice because at some point, you have to remember something.
Right.
And to make a memory, you have to do it repeatedly.
Right.
I'm sorry, that's the way the brain works, okay?
That's why you have to show your work in math.
Right.
You show your work so that you can, you know,
practice
those.
You have to practice, okay? There are things in school you just have to practice. It just comes with the territory. And the most common phrase is, practice makes perfect. Well, one day, my dear colleague here said, no, practice makes permanent.
Mm-hmm.
I found that quote.
Did you?
It exists. I thought you invented it.
Oh, you know what? I have no idea where it comes from.
Really?
Where did
you hear that?
I don't know.
Because I only heard it from you.
Yeah.
But then I was reading the stuff last night and putting together a lesson, and here it is. Practice makes permanent. I said, no, practice makes permanent.
Right. Right. And so that's why, but this is why it's important that you're practicing in a way that is giving you feedback so that you know that you're doing it the correct way.
Right. No sense practicing the wrong thing.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think I heard it in high school, when I was in high school, from one of my teachers.
Yeah, I found it. I hope I can find it again. I was working on it after class last night, so I was kind of tired, but I thought, oh, yeah, burning.
Now, the sixth principle is feedback. And again, this kind of goes along with the practice thing, that you have to be able to give informative, corrective, guiding feedback that helps the student know, you know, what to do, what not to do. And again, this is one of those that is absolutely critical for parents.
Sure.
You know, you don't have to be a teacher for this, some of these to be important.
Kids have to know they're doing it the right way. Right. Again, there's no sense practicing the wrong thing.
Yeah. So. I was meeting with a kid the other day, and he is zapped so much from his parents for doing things wrong. He has no idea if what he's doing is right or wrong until he gets the feedback that he's doing it wrong.
Right.
He has no idea. And so you have to get that feedback that, yes, this is the right way to do it, or you're doing a good job. Adjust it this way just a little bit, or let's try it a different way. But that feedback that's clear and explanatory is really important.
And students want that. They ask for it. Am I doing this right?
Yeah. The seventh principle is self-regulation.
Wow. This is an important one.
Yeah. So kids have to be able to, they have to regulate their own learning, their own emotions, their own behaviors.
That's right. And they should achieve this by the end of third grade. Mm-hmm. We don't expect a first grader to self-regulate. They take directions and they do what they're told. And it has to be done this way. You know, if the teacher says we have to do it this way, there can only be one way to do it. By, and they don't know that they're doing it right. It requires somebody else, typically a teacher or a parent, to say that, yes, this is accurate.
Right, because otherwise they're practicing it the wrong way.
That's right. So by the end of third grade, students should be able to self-regulate. Mm-hmm. And by self-regulation, we mean things like they should be able to evaluate their own work.
Right.
They should be able to keep their materials organized. They should know what materials go with which subjects. Mm-hmm. They should be able to make, to learn things on their own. And so they begin to take over their own learning, so that from kindergarten to third grade, we are acquiring knowledge. After third grade, students begin to acquire they begin to teach themselves.
Right.
We expect them to read for meaning by fourth grade. You
learn
to read through the third grade, and then you read to learn from fourth grade on. That's the expectation.
Yeah.
So by the end of third grade, students should be able to self-regulate. And if they can't, that could signal a problem later on.
Mm-hmm. Right. It doesn't... I had two thoughts at the same time. That's weird.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
There's two pieces to this. One is, sometimes you have to teach those skills directly.
That's right.
We do not do a very good job of that.
No.
Generally speaking, we don't do a very good job of helping kids know what they need to do. This is what organization looks like. This is how I organize. So often parents and teachers will impose their system on their kids, and that's good early on. But as the child ages, the child has to sort of find his or her own way.
Right.
So, you know, I've talked to parents who have, you know, their system is a color coding system. So, you know, the literature folder is white, and the math folder is red, and they have it organized that way. If that system doesn't make sense to the kid, for whatever reason, it's not going to help them. And so they have to be able to adapt it to fit it for themselves. The other piece is that as kids get older, the demands and self-regulation skills are going to expand as well. And surprisingly, not surprisingly, I think unfortunately, what happens is that there are kids who adapt very well early on. Mm-hmm. They shift and adjust and they manage things. They don't need to organize their time to study because they are, you know, they are quick enough and they pick it up in class. But what unfortunately happens is that then they get to high school and then, or maybe even to college, and they don't have these underlying self-regulation skills of time management and organization. And so they have no idea how to take notes, how to study, how to do some of this. So we have to teach those skills directly.
That's right. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because we do have to teach them. And now more and more teachers are aware that we have to teach self-regulation. It doesn't happen automatically because the part of the brain that is in charge of self-regulation is the frontal lobe.
Right.
And that is the last part of the brain to mature. And so we can't expect children just to do that. They have to be taught how to do it. It's not something they possess when they're 9 and 10 and 11. And yet we expect them to be able to do it.
Right.
Okay. But yes, it takes some direct instruction.
Yeah. The last principle within this overall domain is creativity. And we've talked, not we, as a society, as a system, we've talked about the arts and creativity and the fact that we're moving more and more towards the use of rubrics and, you know, specific outlines for how things are done. I was talking to a college student the other day, and he has a paper that he's got to work on that's due in a couple of weeks. And I said, well, you know, what are you writing about? And he says, well, they haven't posted the rubric yet. And I said, well, does the rubric tell you what you have to write? Oh, no, I'm going to see what the rubric says, and so I know what I have to do, and then I'll kind of go from there. So all of his learning as it relates to this paper that he's got to write is going to be dependent upon the rubric. And it really just brings in and tightens the realm of learning to such a small area.
Right.
You know, there's so much more to learning that comes from creativity.
As a parent and as an educator, and as a teacher of teachers, I struggle with this one because over the years, because of this high stakes test mentality, we have started to think of the correct answer, and there can only be one correct answer. I remember when my children were in elementary school, and they had reading comprehension assignments, and they would ask, sometimes they would come to me and say, Dad, I'm not sure which is the best answer here. Now, these are kids in fourth and fifth grade, and I would read it, and I would say, I'm not sure.
Right.
It could be either B or C. Depending on how you look at it.
Right.
And I said, no, Dad, there's only one answer. It has to be one or the other. And frequently I would get it wrong.
Right.
You know, and they would come to me and say, Dad, you got that one wrong. There's something flawed about a system that demands that kind of precision, where it doesn't really exist in the real world.
Right.
And we impose that on children so that they're afraid to think about it. They're only concerned about what is the right answer.
Right.
The boy you're talking about, who's waiting for the rubric. Tell me what I have to do. Give me the recipe.
Right.
I'll follow the recipe.
Right.
And I expect to get this grade. You told me I have to do this to get an A. So I will do that, and I expect to get an A.
Yeah.
And
it's troublesome.
That's not the way education works. I'm sorry.
The way it should work.
I was at William & Mary 2 years ago. And I was doing a talk to Virginia Association of School Psychologists. And a person at the table said, we have done away with rubrics at our college.
Oh, that's nice.
We no longer, we ask our students to do their best work. They're not asked to be creative necessarily, but they're given leeway to create their own work, to do their own work. Just do your best work is what we ask our students to do. And I thought, wow, what a refreshing approach to education compared to the rubric approach, which says you have to do this
right.
way.
Right. Now, the next overall psychological domain is motivation.
Well, now settle in.
Yeah.
Because this will take about 3 hours to cover this section. How many are in this section? We have to divide this up.
There's just four. It's all right.
This is such an important topic.
So the first principle within the domain of motivation is intrinsic motivation. And you know what? I should have looked at which podcast it was the date that we posted it, because we've done a number of podcasts on intrinsic motivation and the importance of intrinsic motivation. And what they say here in this little bolded area here is key. And it says, students tend to enjoy learning and to do better when they are more intrinsically rather than extrinsically motivated to achieve. So when we can make them intrinsically motivated, what makes them intrinsically motivated? Success, interest, mm-hmm. when it's tied to something that they right. are that they can relate to, mm-hmm. those things increase intrinsic motivation.
Right.
So mm-hmm. that's, you know, I hate to make it seem as though I'm overly simplifying it, but that really is it. I mean, if you can present it in a way that it's meaningful. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the movie Big. Do you remember that movie
yeah.
with, mm-hmm. with Tom Hanks?
Right.
I remember he had already been turned into the adult. And
adult
he was in there talking with the kid at the dinner party about algebra. And he was presenting algebra through basketball.
Right.
And he was talking about how many free throws and how many this and that. And it helped the kid. It related to the kid. And he was able to... he got it, you know? So when you can make it meaningful, it's going to increase intrinsic motivation.
But so many of us rely on extrinsic motivation.
Right.
You know, do it or else I'm going to hurt you and so I'm going to give
right.
you a zero. I'm going
right.
to give you a low grade. And there has to be this do it or else
punitive.
Mentality.
Mm-hmm. So. The second principle is
mastery goals. Right.
And mm-hmm. we have some schools in our area who have shifted to a mastery model where... The goal is to get students to mastery, and that kind of goes back to some of the stuff we were talking about yeah. with practice and all of that. But the goal is not just to present the information and then move on to the next thing. It's to make sure that every piece along the way is mastered by all of the students.
And by all the students.
By all the students. Right. And, you know, there's some challenges to that.
Right.
But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the idea, again, is just that the purpose of learning is to master these skills.
That's right. And two things here. What does a C mean? You know, mm-hmm. a C means, well, it used to mean adequate.
Mean.
Okay. Now it means you haven't mastered it yet.
Right.
That's what most people would interpret a C mm-hmm. as. You're getting there, you haven't mastered mm-hmm. the material. We've talked before about giving zeros,
right.
giving a kid a zero. A zero has no place in school. Because it means I accept your decision not to master this material.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do this mm-hmm. and show that you've mastered it, then I'm going to give you a zero.
Mm-hmm.
That's all wrong. What mastery learning would say is, no, this is important, and I don't accept your decision not to master
right.
it. Okay, and that's what I like about the mastery goals.
Right.
Is, no, this is what we're doing here is important.
Well,
you don't get not to do it.
Well, and if a student or your child has made the decision not to master it, then you got to go back up to the last principle and say, well, why don't we have intrinsic motivation here? What
right.
do we need to do to increase
That's
intrinsic
right.
motivation so that they want to master it?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So they all tie together. The next principle would include teacher expectations.
Teacher expectations. Right.
So what the teacher is expecting affects the student's mm-hmm. motivation.
Right.
I think that one of the biggest challenges when I see students, especially middle school students, who are struggling in school a little bit, one of their primary struggles relates to teacher expectations.
Mm-hmm.
She just wants too much. Now, you know, they're associating the curriculum and everything to the teacher, and of course it does go back to the curriculum and the expectations of the
right.
school building, but when teachers have the expectations, teachers tend to get their expectations met. So if a teacher expects a student to fail, mm-hmm. that student's probably going to fail.
Most kids go into a class, whether it's first grade or first year of college.
Mm-hmm.
What does my teacher expect?
Right.
I mean, they go in with that mindset,
right.
you know, what's expected here?
Yeah.
And they very quickly grasp what is expected in this class. That's why we have drop ed in college.
Right.
The expectations are too high,
mm-hmm.
or you don't think you can meet them, you have this opportunity to drop the class. Or
right.
if you're not prepared adequately,
mm-hmm.
Take a lower level course, or
yeah.
take an upper level course if you've already had the material.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, it's so critical that teachers have that belief in their students and convey that
right.
belief in their mm-hmm. students. Because that
and they should be high. One of the things we know about motivation is if you have high expectations, kids are going to be motivated to reach it.
Right. And the last principle within this domain is
goal setting. Right.
And you know, again, when we are able to set meaningful, achievable, maybe mm-hmm. rigorous, but achievable mm-hmm. goals, we're going to be more motivated to do what we need to do to achieve those goals.
That's right.
So we want to make sure that we create and encourage and teach kids how to set some goals that are meaningful and that are appropriate.
Because if they're pursuing their goals, they're going to have more intrinsic motivation.
Right.
I want to do this.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, but again, the goals have to be meaningful, and you want to have short-term and long-term goals and, and everything. Mm-hmm. That wasn't too bad. We got through that domain pretty quickly. The next domain is social and emotional dimensions. Mm-hmm. And this is an area I think that is often overlooked, because we don't really think, when we think about learning, and you know, there are many times when we have information from schools where the student is struggling socially and emotionally at school, but you know what, the grades are okay, so you know,
they're passing their tests.
Yeah,
they're all passing their tests,
so we don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. But the social emotional domain is critical.
How many domains were there in this 20 principles?
Five, I think.
Mm-hmm. Five. Okay. And what we're saying here is that all five are important.
Yeah.
In a school setting, there should be a consistent effort for all five to be in play.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done over the past, since 2000, is we have shifted and put too much emphasis on academic achievement.
Right.
And we have allowed some of these others to diminish.
Right.
And I think there, and this is one of the things I think we've allowed to diminish. We talk about bullying, but we don't spend much time developing social and emotional skills in children.
Yeah.
We allow children, well, if we place too much emphasis on any one, the others are going to diminish.
Right.
And I think this has been one of the ones that has suffered from neglect.
Yeah. So the first principle within this domain is the social context.
Mm-hmm.
Learning is situated within a particular setting,
right,
and a particular social context. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned bullying. If a student doesn't feel safe, right, he's not going to learn very well. If a student if there's too many distractions because the social context is too distracting, he's not going to learn very well. Mm-hmm. So that social context, those social emotional, environmental aspects are really important. You know, if you have a student, if there's another student in the class that keeps making noises or keeps, you know, interrupting or keeps interfering, it's going to make it difficult for the other students to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now there may be one of these other principles need to be are at play with that student who keeps causing the disruption, and we need to figure out what that is. But it doesn't change the fact that there's this dynamic interaction between that student who's struggling and all the other students in the class.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, so it's really important that we think about that social context.
Right.
The third, the next principle within this social emotional domain are the interpersonal relationships.
That's right.
And again, it goes back to safety. We did a podcast this past week on the importance of relationships as it relates to health and overall functioning. And the reality is that, you know, when we are social creatures and we need these interactions, we need these relationships to be healthy.
Right. And so many times we have children who come in and say they don't want to go to school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They don't feel safe. They feel marginalized. They feel that there's no place for them in this. If we're going to educate children in groups, as we do in this country, I mean, we don't have private tutors. Like Thomas Jefferson had a private tutor. We educate children in groups. We then have the obligation to manage the groups. And if all of our effort is on getting through the curriculum for that day, you don't have time to do both.
Right.
When we were in school, especially elementary school, there was an emphasis on managing the group, everybody getting along, and classrooms were safer places.
Right.
Today, if your objective is to get through these skills, if that's what you're being evaluated on, you're not going to devote time to the social and emotional development of your children.
Right.
And we have allowed that
right.
to to diminish a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think we do it at great peril.
Yeah.
Because now we have classrooms that aren't safe.
Right.
Teachers will admit that.
Yeah.
They don't have time to deal with it.
I clearly remember in elementary school times when the teacher, that were some of the students, not me, mm-hmm. other students,
never.
Would get out of line,
right.
and the teacher would say, "That's it. Turn the light off. Everybody put your heads down."
That's right.
And mm-hmm. no talking, no nothing. And I couldn't imagine a situation now where an elementary school teacher could shut the class down for 10 minutes.
Stop the teaching for 10 or 15 minutes. Stop the teaching for an hour.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We have to deal with, this is more important now than whatever we're doing in class.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that today.
Right.
Not in today's rapid-fire curriculum.
Right. And all of that leads to this last principle within this domain, and that's the overall emotional well-being.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
We spent this entire past week talking about meltdowns,
mm-hmm.
and one of the triggers for meltdowns that we talked about was emotional dysregulation.
Right.
When students aren't emotionally regulated, when they can't control their emotional reactions to things, their mm-hmm. their emotional connections to things, when they can't control that and regulate that, they struggle.
Right.
They have a really difficult time.
And if teachers are stressed,
right.
and if teachers feel pressured, they're not going to have the wherewithal,
mm-hmm.
the energy,
mm-hmm.
to address these sorts of issues.
Right.
I had a hair-raising story yesterday.
Yeah.
I didn't hear the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something like a principal went into a room and noticed that the teacher's bulletin board extended 20% farther, I think 20%, than it should have, making it a fire hazard. And the teacher was going to get dinged for that on her evaluation. That is so demoralizing. That
right.
would be, instead of the principal saying, "Hey, remember the fire code, we have to do this,"
yeah.
and laughing about it, and then the teacher corrects it, she's going to get a lower rating because of that. And if you do that to teachers, you're going to demoralize them.
And
if you demoralize them, it's going to get passed on
right.
to the kids they work with.
Yeah.
And they're going to forget about things like the social and emotional development of their children because they're worried about what's
yeah.
happening to them
yeah.
professionally.
Yeah. Well, and we see this in other ways with teachers, grade school teachers, but also college and graduate school mm-hmm. Instructors, where the expectation is that all of your students pass.
Right. That's right.
With good grades.
That's your responsibility.
And so if that pressure is there from the teacher can't manage
mm-hmm.
how to build social and emotional
right.
regulation. They're going to have to focus on
getting everybody to pass.
I'm
sorry that you don't like each other and you don't get along and you're treating each other badly, but the emphasis here is you all have to pass.
Right.
So that's where I'm going to put my effort because we do what we are evaluated on.
Right, exactly. Now, the next domain is context and learning.
Right.
How can the classroom best be managed?
Right.
And so this flows exactly
right.
from what we were just talking about. And classroom conduct is the
right.
first one.
Mm-hmm.
The expectations that we have in the classroom, the expectations that you have at your home, is going to guide
mm-hmm.
and influence your child or your student's ability to
right.
learn, to make good mm-hmm. decisions, and to do what they need to do.
Right.
It's just, mm-hmm. it's almost a direct correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to make sure that we're managing these systems, these contexts, appropriately.
And we're keeping some sense of order.
Right.
I mean, for education to occur, it has to be orderly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has to be an environment. It has to be a context in which everybody has the opportunity to learn.
Right.
The challenge, of course, is you have children in the classroom who have a very hard time
mm-hmm.
regulating their own behavior. And,
mm-hmm.
and it needs to be managed some other way
right.
by somebody else.
Right.
So
the second principle in this area is are the expectations.
Right.
But they don't just say expectations.
Right.
Expectations and support.
To their credit,
they
say expectations and support. And from now on, I'm going to use that in my classes. This mm-hmm. is one of the things that I'm going to incorporate.
Right.
Don't talk to me just about expectations.
Right.
Talk to me about expectations and the support you're going to give to meet those expectations.
Right.
So I really like, that's a rich one. That's a good one.
Yeah. So when you whenever you set a set of expectations or set a group of expectations mm-hmm. for your child or your students, you have to make sure that you have created a system that's going to allow them to meet those expectations.
Right. Have the expectations, but provide the scaffolding, you know, back to Vygotsky.
Right.
Give them the support that they need to meet those expectations. I don't have any trouble with that.
Right.
Set them as high as you want.
Right.
As long as you have the support to help get them there.
Absolutely. The last domain is assessment.
Don't get me started. I can hear it now. Right? Don't get me started on assessment.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Don't get me started. Assessment, because we do have to monitor progress, and there is nothing wrong. We have very strong opinions about high stakes testing and that type Ooh. Of. I'm not going into it. High stakes
Don't
testing
start
as that. It relates to, you know, progress monitoring. That said, it's not as much the testing as it is what we're using the test to do. What decisions we're making based upon the testing. That's really the crux of the problem. We can have expectations, as we were just talking about. We can have a set of standards that people have to achieve or that we want people to achieve. But we need to make sure that we're providing the support and that when we do the assessment and we find that the person isn't making or meeting those expectations, then we have an informative plan of what to do with it, not, well, then you can't graduate. If you don't pass this algebra end of course exam, you can't graduate. It doesn't matter that you made an A in the class. It doesn't matter that you passed geometry and that you did well in chemistry. None of that matters. You didn't pass the EOC, so.
You remember when you said a little while ago, I had two thoughts at one time.
Mm-hmm.
I have eight thoughts right now. They just,
that is,
I'm not even going to talk.
That's overload for.
I'm not even going to talk about assessment.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we have. There are five areas here, right?
Three.
No, I mean five domains in this of the
20. Oh, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
20 domains, 20
principles
in five domains. Okay. Of all the domains, this is the one that leaves me speechless.
Yeah.
It's tragic what has been done, not we have done, because we haven't been a part of it, what has been done with the entire assessment process right. in our country in the last 17 years.
Right. And I think that just so those of you listening know where we come from, we are neuropsychologists. We test
more than anybody else.
We do assessments. We do evaluations.
And of all the psychologists in the world, neuropsychologists rely on assessment and data more than anybody else.
Right. So it is absolutely nothing, no bias against assessment.
That's right.
Because that's what we do. The problem is what we're doing, where the assessments come from, how they're developed. That's a major issue, and then what the data are then used, what decisions are used. It's like so many thoughts. It's so frustrating. What decisions are made based upon those data? That's the frustrating
right.
part.
As a psychologist, as a neuropsychologist. You finish an assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have a stack of data.
Mm-hmm.
I have IQ scores and ratings, but I have a stack of data.
Mm-hmm.
I can either hurt you
right.
or I can help you.
Right.
This is a scalpel.
Mm-hmm.
I can either hurt you or help you with this scalpel,
right.
depending on how I use it.
Yeah.
We have perverted the assessment process to where children are being hurt now
right.
by the assessment right. process. It's not assessment that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's that assessment can help or hinder. And mm-hmm. right now, it's damaging the entire system. It has damaged the entire educational process. Yeah.
I had to testify once in federal court for a case about a young adult who was having some difficulties, some issues. It wasn't criminal court, but it was. Decisions were being made.
Educational decisions.
No, this was actually an immigration case
okay.
That I was working on. And and they were, you know, there's certain pieces of information. He was a young adult, but he had been here his entire life. And, you know, I think his parents brought him here when he was like one or two or something like that. So this is the only life in the United States is all that he had known.
Right.
Now, he had some problems. He grew up in poverty and he had some problems and everything. And so they asked me to do an assessment and they wanted to know, you know, if this guy had, what kind of problems or issues this guy had. One of the tests that I administered came back invalid. So because of the way that he responded and everything, I couldn't really gain any good, strong information, confident information that I would be confident enough to present in federal court. But nonetheless, I had to say, I gave this test. It was invalid, so I can't really talk about it. But I also gave these other tests. Of course, the attorney for the against him latches onto that and wants to talk about the test that's invalid. Well, why was it invalid? You know, doesn't that tell you something about him? And I found myself talking in federal court, and this is, I guess, a long way around to this. We can't misuse tests, and we can't make major decisions like whether or not somebody should be deported, or whether or not somebody should be promoted, or whether or not somebody should graduate based upon a single test result.
Right.
But that's what we're doing.
Right.
That's what our education system is doing. It's making these massive decisions based upon a single test score.
Right. And it's not really the educational system has been forced to do it by lawmakers.
Right.
Okay. Doesn't excuse anybody. Right. Because I think educators should stand up and... I think every professional group should be able to stand up and say, no, this is wrong.
Right.
You know, every once in a while, the American Medical Association will stand up and say, no, this is not good policy.
Right.
And I think every professional organization should have that right.
Yeah.
We have perverted assessment to the point where it has become virtually, it could have been such a powerful tool.
Yeah.
And could have done so much good for so many people. I mean, it is good to keep track of kids.
Right.
Who would argue with that?
Right.
You know, you are making it, but you're not making it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, but let's do something constructive with
right.
that. And right now, we're just hurting kids.
Right.
We're saying, you can't graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what we're saying.
Right.
If you don't have a high school diploma, you can't go in the military.
Right.
You can't get a job.
Yeah.
I mean, you're unemployable.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do with all these... And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are going to be unemployable in a couple of years. What are we going to do with all of them?
And the decisions just make no sense at all.
I met
a gentleman not long ago. Gentleman, he's 19. His family moved to the United States from Puerto Rico when he was 16 years old. So he was in 10th grade when he came over here.
Mm-hmm.
His academic records from Puerto Rico, A's and B's, chemistry, algebra, A's and B's through everything. He moves to Florida and in 10th grade. So the expectation is that he has to pass the 10th grade FSA
Florida,
test,
Florida
Standards Assessment,
right.
in reading. English was not his first language.
Right.
He was in ESOL classes, so English second language classes throughout. He failed the FSA multiple times.
Right.
So despite this history throughout his academic career of A's and B's,
right.
he failed the FSA, the Florida Standards Assessment, and had to get a certificate of completion as opposed to a high school diploma. Makes no sense. We know that this guy doesn't speak English as his primary language. We know that he has passed all of these classes, but we're going to fail him because he didn't pass that test. So it doesn't, or not fail him, but we're just not going to let him graduate.
Physicians
it
take
just makes
the,
any sense.
Physicians take the Hippocratic Oath, which is first do no harm.
Right.
I think educators should take the same oath. I think legislators should be forced to take it.
Look, you're getting into...
But I think the teachers, first do no harm.
Right.
You know, do whatever you want to do. We trust your professional judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Just do no harm.
Right. This last domain, this assessment domain, has three principles in it. Formative and summative assessment, so the importance of making sure that the assessments provide information, valuable information,
That's
useful
true.
Information, and that it's summative, that it encompasses what we need to know about the person.
That's right.
That the the way that we develop these assessment mm-hmm. tools mm-hmm. is the second principle. And the third principle is how we evaluate the assessment.
Right.
And so that all of the stuff that we've been talking about hit those three things.
That's right.
You know, what are we assessing? How are we assessing it? How did we develop those assessment tools?
Right.
And then are we going back and looking at those assessment tools and saying, yeah, they're pretty good? Mm-hmm. Or are we saying, no, we need to
do something wrong here. When 50% of the students who take the test fail the test, mm-hmm. there's something wrong with the test.
There's something wrong. And when you evaluate, this is my favorite, when you evaluate the validity and reliability of the test,
mm-hmm.
and those who evaluate the reliability and validity of the test say, test is okay, gives us good information, but it shouldn't be used to make these kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the decision is made, you know what, we're going to go ahead and use it to make those decisions.
Right. You know, this, the first one is formative and summative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for those of you who are not familiar with those words, a summative assessment is the final assessment.
Right.
Have you learned, it'd be the end of semester exam,
right.
for example, or the end of chapter exam.
Mm-hmm.
That's the summative assessment. But we encourage teachers to do formative assessments, which is we assess along the way.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you get to the summative assessment, mm-hmm. you shouldn't even have to give it because you should know you've been doing all along the way you've been doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we have created with end of course exams is that there are no formative assessments that relate to the summative assessment. The summative assessment is dismembered. It doesn't relate to the formative assessments because the teacher's making the formative assessments and the summative assessment, the end of course exam, comes from someplace completely unrelated.
Right. And so that ties these two of these principles.
Right.
You know, the formative and summative, the formative assessment is developed by the teacher. The summative assessment is developed by a publisher. And what's crazy is that the summative assessment isn't even, it would be one thing if it was developed by the same person who created the curriculum from which the teacher's teaching.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's not.
No.
Mm-mm. It's not. It's just made by some independent group.
That's right.
It just doesn't make sense.
So. It's bad assessment practice is what we have, what has been imposed on the public school system. Private schools don't have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
This has been imposed on a struggling public school system.
Mm-hmm.
And assessment is a huge, huge problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clearly, we could talk about this for a little while longer.
Mm.
But that's those are the 20 principles.
20 principles.
It is well worth a read. It is well worth going into this document and kind of clicking on some of the links, especially if you're an educator, especially if you are educator of grade school through mm-hmm. college and graduate school. If you're a parent, these are great things to know about because then you are informed about what your child's school should be doing, but also what some things that you could be doing at home mm-hmm. to help your child.
Right.
But these are all really important principles. Childhood learning, adult learning.
What I really like about these is that they are the psychological principles mm-hmm. that apply to education.
Right.
And by psychologists and teachers. The woman who spearheaded this whole thing, who was in charge of it, is a psychologist. She has her master's degree in psychology, but she's also an educator, K-12. She's a high school teacher. And so it brings together the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
And it's an enormous contribution, I think,
absolutely.
That it brings psychology and education together. Very practical. And it's a really, really impressive contribution
mm-hmm.
to education.
Definitely.
So, yeah, take a look at it.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you what you think of it. If you have any thoughts.
Or you want to talk more about any of these things.
Maybe a 21st principle that should be in there. Who knows? So, all right, so that's it for today.
I guess.
Until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.